This is Nachyomi, Sefer Shofatim, chapter 8. The men of Ephraim complained to Gideon that they were not invited to join him in the battle against Midian. He only called to them and involved them at the very end when the two princes, Orev and Ze'ev, had run ahead and escaped and needed to be captured. Gideon very diplomatically responds to the people of Ephraim, saying that they were too good for the basic battle against Midian, and that it was only necessary to employ their outstanding skill in order to defeat the most difficult enemies and accomplish the most difficult tasks, namely capturing the two fugitive princes. So basically he flatters them and tells them that they were the elite commandos and it would have been beneath them to be summoned for the battle against Midian. The people of Ephraim are satisfied with this response. And with these words, Gideon manages to maintain peace amongst the Shevatim, amongst the tribes. We'll see that this is somewhat of a foreshadowing of what is to come when future Shofatim do not handle the feistiness of the Bnei Ephraim as skillfully as Gideon does here. Gideon and his men are still in pursuit of two other princes of Midian, Zebach and Salmunna, who remained fugitives. The troops become very, very tired, the 300 troops who are with Gideon. And so Gideon stops at Sukkot, a Jewish city, where he requests some help from the community, some provisions, because his soldiers are just too tired and too hungry to go on like this. The leaders of Sukkot refuse to help, pointing out that really Gideon hasn't shown any reason for them to lend their support at this juncture. He hasn't captured Zebach and Salmunna. He hasn't really liberated them all from the dominion of these princes, and so therefore they have no need to show him any loyalty. Gideon rebukes them and says that when he has successfully completed the mission, he will come back and punish them. He comes to Penuel, makes another request for help. He receives a similar response, that they have no reason to help him. There's no indication that he's done anything, that Gideon has done anything for them yet, and therefore they're not ready to put their support behind him. And Gideon again warns that when he comes back, he is going to take revenge against the people of Penuel who refused to assist him in his time of need. Now, when Gideon does eventually capture Zebach and Salmunna, he keeps his word. He comes back to Sukkot, gets a list of the elders of the city, and whips them with thorns and thistles. He also goes to Penuel, destroys the tower that they had in Penuel, and kills many of the inhabitants. So he's serious about backing up his word, and these are not empty threats that he's making against those who are defying him or refusing to support him. The chapter then records a somewhat cryptic dialogue between Gideon and his captives, Zebach and Salmunna, the two princes that he was able to arrest and to capture. Gideon asks them to identify the men that they killed on Har Tavor, on Mount Tavor. They say that their victims looked just like Gideon, and that they had the appearance, Kitoar Bnei HaMelech, like the appearance of the sons of the king. This is somewhat cryptic, and there's a question of, why is Gideon asking them, interrogating them? Why doesn't he simply execute them, since they are, in fact, enemies of the Jewish people? But in any case, Gideon informs Zebach and Salmunna that the men that they had killed were his own brethren, and had they spared the lives of his relatives, he wouldn't be killing them right now. This is, again, very interesting, because why should Zebach and Salmunna's fate be dependent upon any personal slight they committed against Gideon? The fact that they are oppressors of the Jewish people should be enough. But be that as it may, Gideon instructs first his son to kill Zebach and Salmunna. The young boy is too nervous and hesitant and intimidated to carry out the task. Zebach and Salmunna themselves request that Gideon kill them, either because of the kavod involved, the respect issue of having a child kill them, it's really beneath their dignity, or because they figured that he would be able to finish them off more quickly and less painfully. In any case, Gideon does the job, and he does execute the two princes. Now, upon his return to the mainland, the Jews beg Gideon to become their king. They're ready to have a monarch. He refuses and says that Hashem is the only king of the Jewish people and that there's no need for any monarch at this time. He takes up a collection of earrings, jewelry, and other spoils of war, and he makes an ephod, some kind of a breastplate or a garment that can be, that's for the purpose of display. He displays it in his city Ophrah, And the Navi mentions that later on it became a source of trouble. It ensnared even the family of Gidon himself and the Jewish people. Apparently it became some fetish object or some object of worship that was linked to idolatry or superstition further on down the road. But at this point it seemed to be some kind of a symbol or a reminder of the victory in this battle so that the people would recognize Hashem. But it is noteworthy that it was placed in Gidon's own city, as we will see in a moment. The chapter then describes the many wives and children that Gidon had. He even had a concubine who bears him a son who turns out to be a very key figure in the next story and who goes by the name of Avimelech. Now, for the rest of Gidon's life, the Jewish people remained secure and stable, but right after his death, they revert to idolatry and begin worshiping Baal Berit, one of the Canaanite gods. And as we're going to see, not only were the Jews disloyal to Hashem who had saved them, they're also going to be disloyal to Gidon and his family. Now, there are a couple of points in this chapter that are worth highlighting in terms of concept. One is the theme of kingship, which keeps resurfacing in the book of Shofatim, and of course is one of the key themes of Shofatim, the lead-up or the evolution of the Jewish people towards their own federal government, if you will, or centralized government. Gidon seems to have an ambivalent attitude toward the possibility of becoming the king, truthfully, because on one hand, he denies any interest in being the king, and he doesn't establish a monarchy, but on the other hand, he takes it upon himself to punish people who refuse to support him, which is a kind of kingly thing to do. In other words, he's accusing them, for all intents and purposes, of treason against the crown, of being disloyal to the king. He also implies that he would have been willing to spare the lives of Zebach and Salmona if they hadn't killed his own family, or members of his own family, which assigns a special role to his royal family. And Zebach and Salmona themselves, when they describe the victims of their crimes, which incidentally are not mentioned anywhere clearly in the Tanakh, and we only know about because of the fact that Gidon accuses them of this, or brings this to their attention here, the fact that when they're describing it, describing their victims, they call them Kitoar b'nei HaMelech, that they are like you, Gidon. They have the resemblance, or they have the appearance of the sons of the king. Again, attributing something kingly to Gidon, implying that the fact that they looked regal made them comparable to Gidon himself. So they are also placing Gidon in a kind of royal position through their words. Now, Gidon instructs his son to execute Zebach and Salmona, which is something that normally a king who intended to pass the torch to the next generation and to have his son take over after him would do. He's training his son to take on his role. He also places the commemorative ephod in his own city, which, on one hand, we could say the ephod was to remind us of the miraculous battle that was won with the help of Hashem against the enemies of Israel. But on the other hand, placing it in his own city is underscoring the fact that he played a pivotal role here, that his family played a pivotal role and deserves honor and recognition for their achievement. He even names his son Avimelech, which means my father is the king. Naming your son my father is the king is essentially saying you are the king. Now, given that we've already seen that Gidon struggles with a sense of self-importance to some extent, we saw in the last chapter that during the battle he says, for Hashem and for Gidon, among other things. So it doesn't come as much of a surprise to us that he would have some interest in kingship. We could say, for simplicity's sake, that Gidon is interested in the benefits and perks of kingship, but doesn't really want the responsibilities of kingship. He takes for himself many wives, he has many children, he lives like a king, but he doesn't go so far as to take upon himself the role and responsibility and burden of being the king. It's interesting to note that the two communities that Gidon confronts, Sukkot and Penuel, are both related to the meeting between Yaakov and Esav. When Yaakov returns from living with Lavan and encounters Esav, the night before his meeting with Esav, he struggles with an angel at a place which he afterwards calls Peniel or Penuel. Subsequent to his struggle his confrontation with Esav, he settles in a place called Sukkot. This seems to indicate that there is a connection between Gidon and Yaakov, who has to prove himself. Yaakov has been out of the picture for over 20 years when he returns to the land of Israel. He has to demonstrate that he's entitled to lead the Jewish community and the Jewish nation in the Holy Land after having been out of the picture for so long. Gideon similarly has to show, has to demonstrate his entitlement, his right to claim leadership of the Jewish people, and has to prove his credentials. And so he goes to these two cities, which perhaps remind us of Yaakov going through the same process. This is also solidified further by the connection to Shechem here, the fact that Shechem plays a role in the story of Gideon, and Shechem plays a similar central role in the same period of Yaakov's life. He spends much time in Shechem. Now, finally, there's no doubt that the collection of earrings and jewelry is reminiscent of the collection that Aharon HaKohen made to construct the golden calf. And even the language that's used seems to be a paraphrase here of the language that we find in the Torah in the description of that incident. Now, what's the connection between the two incidents? Well, Gideon was fashioning a kind of idol. It was a symbolic item that was going to be placed in his hometown and was going to remind people of salvation that Hashem had wrought for them. In a way, it would promote a kind of hero worship of himself and his family, and would also serve to reassure the people of God's presence, that Hashem's presence was with them. Gideon's commemorative ephod sublimates in a way the desire to appoint a king by allowing them not to appoint a king, but in a way to place him in the position of a celebrity, of somebody worthy of admiration and recognition, but not necessarily of the powers of a king. Not wanting to accept any official title of leadership, he preferred to kind of cultivate the image of being a leader and a monarch, which gave him all the benefits of being a king and without any of the drawbacks. So again, the idea of the ephod was a compromise between the desires of the people to have a king and perhaps to have a more concrete expression of Hashem's presence in their lives and the reality which was removed from that. So therefore, the ephod is very similar to the golden calf, which came when Moshe Rabbeinu was out of the picture, when the people felt that they were without a king, and when the people felt that they were without a clear indication of Hashem's presence. The golden calf filled that void, and here too the ephod is filling that void. And in both cases, the choice of creating this physical symbol turned out to be a problematic and a damaging one.